If you have a Bible or other device, you might like to open it to Psalm 135, one of the Psalms we haven't read this morning. And I will just read to you, if I may, the first 14 verses. Psalm 135. O praise the Lord. Laud ye the name of the Lord. Praise it, O servants of the Lord. You who stand in the house of the Lord, in the courts of the house of our God. O praise the Lord, for the Lord is gracious. O sing praises to his name, for it is lovely. For why? The Lord has chosen Jacob to himself, and Israel for his own possession. For I know that the Lord is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatever the Lord pleased, that he did in heaven and in earth, and in the sea, and in all deep places. He brings forth the clouds from the ends of the world, and sends forth lightnings with the rain, bringing the winds out of his treasures. He smote the firstborn of Egypt, both of man and beast. He has sent tokens and wonders into the midst of you, O thou land of Egypt, upon Pharaoh and all his servants. He smote divers nations, and slew mighty kings, Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, the king of Bashan, and all the kingdoms of Canaan, and gave their land to be a heritage, even a heritage for Israel his people. Your name, O Lord, endures forever, so does your memorial, O Lord, from one generation to another. For the Lord will judge his people and be gracious to his servants. May we bow our heads as we sit. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. I'd like you to keep that psalm open, if you would, and particularly concentrating on the last two verses, that the name of the Lord endures forever, for the Lord will bring justice and compassion, show compassion on his people. What is the use of history, and especially church history? Having taught the subject as I have for most of my life, this is a question rather close to my heart, as you might imagine, particularly towards the end of the semester, when the thing that every teacher dreads appears, the student evaluation form. I don't know whether you have. Do you have them here? You do, yes, so you know what I'm talking about. It's the time when the students get their revenge, on their lecturers. And, of course, everybody trembles when this happens. And I used to hand these out, of course, every year at the end, or every semester, really, at the end. And the questions were very interesting. They start off with things like, is the lecturer prepared for the subject? Yeah, 10 out of 10, you see, for that. Is the lecturer enthusiastic? This was America, you see, where enthusiasm is compulsory. So you had to have, is the lecturer enthusiastic? And I'd get 11 out of 10 for that. Tremendously enthusiastic. Does the lecturer know what he's talking about? Yes, 10 out of 10 for that. And then you get down to the bottom, you see, when the real questions comes, which is, do you think this course will be of any use in your future ministry? And to this, I always got 0 out of 10. Oh, yeah. It wasn't personal, It's just that I realized, you see, after a while, that while everybody liked me personally, and they liked the funny stories I told and things like that, it was really I was offering them light entertainment to fill in the time between the serious courses, like Hebrew and biblical studies and so on. And after a while, you just get used to this. You see, you think to yourself, well, I'm not going to win on this one, so we might as well tell a few more funny stories. Change the facts a little bit, which you can always do if you just call it the new perspective on something. And, it sounds good. You just get away with this and just work my way through to retirement. I mean, why let it worry you? You're not going to win, so just, make it work for you. And so it's a great privilege, you see, a great wonder to me to be able to open the scriptures and find here in Psalm 135, which is something that most of the students would take seriously, because it's the Bible, and say, well, God himself, inspires the psalmist to think about the history of Israel. You see, going back to Egypt and the deliverance from Egypt, the wilderness journey of the people, reminding the Israelites. You see, when he wrote this, we don't know who it was or when it was written, but there was nobody alive at the time who had been through this. It was ancient history to them. And yet it comes back. You see, they're reminded of this. Why? Because they are reminded that they belong to a people who have been delivered over the centuries from their enemies. Israel was a small nation surrounded by big and powerful ones. The big and powerful ones were its enemies. You might say nothing much has changed, still true today. But there they were, you see, Egypt, the great empire there, which had enslaved them for hundreds of years, and they had escaped. Sihon, the king of the Amorites, perhaps a bit more obscure, but to those who had to face him, and Og, the king of Bashan at the time, and the kings of Canaan, they were frightening to Israel. And the Israelites knew that they were a small nation. They knew that they were unimportant. They knew that there was really no logical reason why they should exist and why they should triumph over their enemies. Read Deuteronomy chapter 7, you see, where Moses said to the people, "Why did God choose you? It wasn't because you were a great nation. It wasn't because you were a powerful nation. There's really no reason in human terms why you should be chosen. But God has put his love on you. God has picked you out. And God will preserve you and protect you against all your enemies, however powerful, however great. And you who are the little guy, you who are the one who are persecuted, kicked in the teeth, enslaved, exiled, and goodness knows what, by all the nations around you, you who will suffer persecution through centuries, nevertheless will know that at the heart of your existence, at the heart of your consciousness of being a nation, I will be present. I will protect you. I will guide you. I will keep you." And today, 3,000 years perhaps after this psalm was written, this is what we see. Where are the pharaohs today? Gone. You know, the pyramids are still there, just about, but the rest is gone. Where are the Amorites? Who were the Amorites? You know, nobody really knows. If you know the answer to that question, you're not a normal person. You know, you've studied. And goodness knows, well, that's true. You know, your theological students have to learn. They're peculiar. Og, the king of Bashan, what does that mean? You know, nobody has any idea. Why not? Because these people have disappeared. They have disappeared without trace. But Israel is still with us, for better or for worse. You see, it's still at the center of human history today because God has been faithful to his people. Now, you and I belong to this tradition. The Apostle Paul tells us we have been grafted in to Israel. You see, the unfaithful ones, the branches have been taken away. We read in Romans 9, 10, 11, and so on. They've been lifted up, but we have been grafted in. Their history is our history. We belong to these people. And we have the same promises, the same perspective, the same life today that they had. We are not a great nation. You know, there's nothing much to be said about us as people. The Apostle Paul, in writing to the Corinthians, said, "Look around you. You know, there aren't many rich, there aren't many wise, there aren't many important people in this world. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world in order to shame the wise." You see, God has chosen little people, insignificant people, people whom the world doesn't know, people whom the world rejects, despises, and ignores. And he has chosen those people and put his name on them, put his love in them, blessed them, guided them, and drawn them to himself as a people who will reign in triumph in eternity. You and I belong to this people. This is who we are. This is our identity. And we are one with Israel in this. You see, we belong to this. History is a reminder of what God has done and a promise of what God will do in our lives. History is a story of people, sometimes of nations, and of course that's what we read mainly in the Old Testament, but also of individuals. Individuals who may be otherwise quite unknown, but who nevertheless, in their own way, have been great saints of God. I could tell you many stories this morning about different people that I've known, but I'm only going to tell you one, because one which is particularly on my heart has been for the last day or so as I prepared for this sermon, just to illustrate this point and to give you some encouragement. Margaret was born on the 15th of March in 1884. She was born on a farm in the Canadian wilderness at a time when that was a distant place. You see, not many people went there. There were no sort of mod cons, nothing like that. It was a difficult life. She was the youngest of five children, and soon after she was born, her mother died. Father remarried. The stepmother wasn't really interested in the children. Now, I don't know. I've heard various stories. I don't really know what the truth is. 1884 was a little bit before my time. But what I do know, not long, but a little bit, what I do know is that the four older children all died. And when Margaret was 13, she realized that there wasn't much of a future there with her father and her stepmother. And so he went off to the city and got a job as a maid in a family, a wealthy family. They did that in those days. This was before, you know, the modern conveniences that we have now. And she did all the washing and the cleaning and preparing and so on. And she was integrated into that family. And I suppose most of what she ever learned, because she only went to primary school, most of what she ever learned, she must have learned from them, you know, during those years. Well, she stayed with them for quite a while because she went when she was 13. And as far as I know, she didn't marry until she was in her late 20s. So about half of her life that time, all her youth, was spent in this way. Well, eventually she met a blacksmith, married him, and they settled down. They had a little plot of land, and on that plot of land they would keep horses. And in those days, of course, they would hire the horses out, you know, to people, sort of milk trucks and so on going around. And this is how they made their living. And of course, he was a blacksmith, so he could shoe the horses and so on. They were churchgoers, faithful, loyal, you know, Christian people. And in the early 1920s, by that time, they had three children, a boy and two girls. But then things started to go wrong. In late 1926, the girl, the elder girl of the two, developed an ear infection. Nobody seemed to know what it was. Of course, there wasn't penicillin or anything in those days. It was very difficult to deal with. And the long and short of it was this six-year-old girl died. At almost exactly the same time, her eight-year-old son was going to school one day, and this was the beginning of winter, you have to remember. And the ditches and so on were freezing over. And the little boy, for some reason or other, thought he could walk across the ditch because it had ice on it. And he went across, but he fell in because the ice hadn't thickened enough. You see, it was just the start of winter. So he went on to school, soaking wet. But the school had rules. You know, schools always seem to have rules. And one of the rules that nobody had ever heard before but was sort of trotted out on this occasion, soaking wet children cannot stay in school. So the teacher, who of course kept the rules, said, you've got to go home again. So he went home in the cold, you know, it was through the snow and so on, through everything else, soaking wet. Of course, he was freezing by the time he got home. Caught pneumonia, died. Margaret buried her two children on Christmas Eve in that year together. They died. A couple of years later, her husband developed arthritis, couldn't work anymore. So she was left sort of to, you know, mind the horses and what have you, while he sort of, well, he didn't really do very much. But whatever this disease was, I don't really know. I never met him, of course. I don't know. But he died in the prime of life. Sort of early 1930s sometime. And so Margaret was left with her daughter, again, faithful, you know, believing people, to to look after to the horses, to try to live and eke out a living. It was depression, so on. Not an easy time. Then along came the war, of course, and the government decided in its wisdom that they were going to requisition their little plot of land and put an army base there. That's all very well, of course, if you're fighting Hitler, but not so good if you lose your living in the process. Of course, they were compensated and so on. They got a house and all the rest of it. But it basically meant that Margaret, who had never had training of any kind, was now dependent on her daughter, who would have to go out and earn her living. Her daughter would, I guess, have been about 18 years old at that time, and she had to go and earn a living for the family. Well, just the two of them, but still. If that wasn't enough, in 1942... Margaret developed a little sore on her lip. She thought it was a cold sore. And she, you know, put ointment on it, cream and so on, for a couple of years, and nothing didn't go away. So finally she went to the doctor, because people in those, there was no health service. You had to pay to go to the doctor. So she saved up and went to the doctor to see what it was. And they did a scan, an x-ray or whatever, discovered it was cancer. Well, cancer is a scary thing even today, with all the advances we have. But back in the 1940s, if somebody told you you had cancer, that was it. That was a death sentence for most people. That's what they thought. But the tragedy in her case was that it wasn't a death sentence, because it was a skin cancer. It was a sort of superficial cancer. It wasn't in the vital organs. And instead of dying, she gradually lost half of her face. You know, it was just eaten up by this cancer, and it had to be removed in successive things. She had various operations and so on. By the time I knew her, in the 1950s, she was an old lady who was basically a wreck. I mean, you know, she was a half-human being. She was. Her face had gone. Half of her face had gone, and she really couldn't go outside. She felt too ashamed even to go to church because of the way she looked. People would stare at her and wonder what on earth had gone wrong, and so on. You know, she was confined basically to the house. I mean, she could walk. She could go out if she wanted to, but she just couldn't face this kind of thing. And so she sat in the house day after day, year after year, seeing nobody or very few people who would come to visit her, doing nothing. I met her in those years when I was a little boy. And the funny thing about children, you know, children accept what they find around them. I mean, she was an ugly old hag. She was. Not her fault, but she was. The disease had eaten away in this way. But I never noticed. Of course, because that's the only way I knew her. To me, she was just this mysterious person from another world, and you know, very fascinating because she was the oldest person I knew, and very strange. I mean, where did she come from? You know, what was this, and so on. So I used to go and listen. You see, and she would tell me stories. She would tell me Bible stories. It was from her that I found out about Moses and the Egyptians. It was from her that I found out about Sihon and Og and all these people, because she'd grown up like this. You see, the Bible was the only book she ever read, the only book that they had in the house. And so she told me all these stories. And I remember when I went to kindergarten, she said to me, "You've got to go to Sunday school." She said, "I can't teach you any more than this. I tell you all these things, but I can't go any further than this. You need to go to Sunday school." So obnoxious as I was only six. I'm more obnoxious now, but I was learning in those days. And, badgering my parents. Can you imagine badgering your parents to take you to Sunday school? That was me. Very strange. Anyhow, so finally my parents gave in and took me to Sunday school. And I just loved it because all the magic, you see, it was just a magic world that she was opening up to me. Suddenly, you know, this had a context. It sort of came to life, and I learned, and I just devoured this. You know, the stories from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and learning the Bible and studying all these things. And if it hadn't been for that, I probably wouldn't be standing before you now. You know, I think that's the only evangelistic thing this woman ever did in her entire life. You know, I could be wrong, but as far as I know, that was the only thing she did. You see, she sent me to Sunday school and sort of launched me on my career in this way. Well, she lived to be 80, which was a remarkable thing. But 22 years, she had this cancer. She couldn't go out. You see, just day after day, sitting there doing nothing, dependent entirely on people like me, you know, who didn't care about that, who didn't notice that, and who would go and listen to her stories, listen, talk to her, and so on, and just try to sort of keep her company as much as we could during those years. Well, we celebrated her 80th birthday. I'll never forget. It was a Sunday towards the end of winter. And the next day, for some reason, I don't know why, she took it into her head to get an axe and went out and chopped the ice, because it was the end of the winter and she wanted to chop the ice so that the footpath would be cleared and the snow would melt quicker and so on. So she did this. But it was too much. You know, she exerted herself, went back, and she just took to bed and she never got up again. Cancer somehow was reactivated. And on the Wednesday, this was a Monday, on the Wednesday, I went to see her. And I remember I was only 15 at the time. And 15 is a difficult age, of course, at any time. But I was old enough to know that something was wrong, but not old enough to be able to process exactly what it was. I'd never seen anyone die before, you know, not like that. I mean, I'd seen it, well, I hadn't really seen it even on television, because in those days people didn't die on television. Television was still too new for that sort of thing. So, you know, you didn't really see that. And so I hadn't had this experience, and I didn't really understand what was happening, except she was clearly in pain and suffering. She could hardly breathe. And I went and talked, and she talked to me, and she said, "Don't worry about me." She said, "Don't worry about me. I know where I'm going." She said, "You just keep your faith, you keep close to God, and you live for him. Don't worry about me." I don't know whether she ever spoke again after that, because she went back into a kind of deep sleep or coma, and she was there for about 3 days like that. And she rallied a little bit on the Saturday. I remember it very, very clearly. And my mother, who was looking after her, said, "I'm going to prepare some soup." And so she went to get some hot soup to give to her, hoping that she might, you know, revive her a little bit. And when she brought the soup in, Margaret just sort of moved up a bit like this to get the soup, and then she fell back. And we realized she'd been released from her suffering of 80 years in one way or another. She was an unimportant person. No one would know her of her. Now, I mean, very few people are left alive who ever remembered her, who ever met her. I was reminded of this last year when I went to see my mother, who's older than I am. yeah, but also healthier. It's very worrying. And I always pulled her leg. I said, you know, she's old enough to be on first name terms with Noah. But we were talking about this because it was 50 years since these events had taken place. And I said, you know, Mom, I said, I was very young. I said, I don't really remember very well. But I never heard her complain about anything. And my mother said, no, she never did. In all the years she'd known it, she never did. There was never a word of complaint. I mean, this was a woman who could have blamed the school for killing her son, who could have blamed the government for taking her property and her livelihood. I mean, she went through a lot of suffering. A woman who for 22 years was eaten away by this cancer that wouldn't kill her, you know, that just left her in this terrible state. Year after year like this, unable to relate normally. Until finally, as I say, she went. Who will remember a person like this? Now, why am I telling you this story? I'm telling you this story for two reasons. One, because, of course, she made a great impression on me, and this still remains with me to this day. But also because you are training for ministry, You are training to minister, to serve people like that. You see, I don't know what vision you have of your own future. You see, what are you going to do? Are you going to become a great preacher? Are you going to become a church planter? Are you going to become an evangelist? Are you going to become an entertainment coordinator? That's also known as worship leader. What exactly are you going to do with your life? I don't know. Maybe you don't know either. But if you are going into ministry, you are going to serve a people who were delivered from Egypt 3,000 and however many years ago. George Athos will tell you, he's probably got it down to the date, actual day, but I don't remember precisely, so forgive me if I don't get it quite accurate. These people who have been led, who have been taken, who have been carried, who are nothing in the eyes of the world, but who are children of God in their own special way. And you in your ministry, whatever form it may take, you see, you may become the pastor of a mega church. Well, good for you. You may become a theological college lecturer. I mean, there's no depth to which some people won't sink. And there we are, you know. I'm telling you, it's sad. But just be prepared. It could happen to you. I really don't know. You see what's going to happen. But whatever ministry you have, whatever form it takes, at the bottom, at the root, you will be helping people on their way to heaven. You know, that way may be a hard way. It may be a difficult way. But it's the way that you are going, and you are privileged to be helping them along it. You are privileged to be taking people like Margaret, people who nobody knows, nobody cares about, people who are lost and rejected and so on, and you draw them and you have to lead them and take them the next step of the journey. And maybe like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, you know, you'll get to the river of death and you will be kept there. You will be held there for a time as you help others cross. You will have the privilege of holding their hand as they move from this world to the next, as they go to their reward. You will have the privilege of helping, of praying for them, of guiding them, of keeping them in the last moments of their life. It may be different. You may reach them at an earlier stage, but still, each thing that you do, each thing that you say, will be moving them one step forward to the goal, until the day finally comes when you too will be called home. You too will be told to get into that ship, then get into that boat, cross the river, and hear the trumpets sounding for you on the other side. We don't know when that will be. But the only question I have for you, and indeed the only question that anyone going into ministry needs to be asked, is where will you be when that day comes? Are you preparing for this? Do you understand that this is what you have been called for? That you have been given this immense privilege? The people you are dealing with, you see, may be the foolish things of this world. They may be very small people, people whom nobody remembers. But they are precious in the sight of God. They are people who belong to Him. When you get to heaven, I don't think you're going to find Sihon, the king of the Amorites, there. I mean, I could be wrong. It's a while since I've been, so I don't know. Og, the king of Bashan, most unlikely. But you will meet unknown people. You will meet people whom you might have passed by in the street and ignored because they're really not the kind of people you want to evangelize. You know, they're not the sort of people you want in your church because they're not going to give anything. They're not going to serve in any very obvious capacity. They may sort of detract from your energies by taking you away because you've got to go and visit them at home and read the Bible to them and pray with them and give them some encouragement. And you go away from that thinking, well, nobody in the church, nobody in the world knows anything about this. But God does. You see, God sees. God knows what this is, because these are his people, and these are the people whom you and I are called to serve. And that's really the message I want to leave with you this day from this Psalm 135. That as we think over time, you see, we think over the generations, as we think over the things that God has done in the past, both in the life of the church, the life of his people, and in the lives of us as individuals, not to look down on anyone, not to say that anything that you are called to do is a waste of time, to remember that although Israel was small, although Israel was of no account in the affairs of the world of its time, it was Israel that God had put his love on. It was Israel that God preserved. It is Israel today that remains the only nation still recognizable from Old Testament times. You know, Persia's gone, Rome has gone, Alexander the Great has gone. It's all gone. But Israel is still there. And Israel and the people of God will be there in eternity. You see, small, despised, and rejected though they may be in this life, they are reigning in heaven with Jesus. And what I want to see is for you and me to be reigning in heaven with him as well.